Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Today is bonding day. We've got three bills that we're going to look at, and we will begin with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 273. And we have a list of people who have signed in to testify on that. And we will start with the Oregon School Boards Association, Mr. Morgan Allen, and his panel. Welcome to you all.
All right, well, thank you, Chair Hassan, members of the committee, for your record. My name is Morgan Allen, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association to urge your support for Senate Bill 273, which would represent the first major state investment in school building and renovation since the passage of ballot measure 68 in 2010. And I'm joined by Bruce Lathers from the Salem-Keizer School District and Carol Samuels from Seattle Northwest Securities, who will have some comments as well. So if it's all right, we'll just jump right in. So just to give you a little bit of background, 66% of Oregon voters approved ballot measure 68 in May 2010. And if you remember, this measure made two important changes to the Constitution. The first change was it allowed school districts, when they passed capital construction bonds, to basically not only build new buildings, but to furnish them, to provide libraries, to build computer labs, to do long-term maintenance projects. And the second important change that ballot measure 68 put in the Constitution was it allowed the state to issue general obligation bonds for school construction costs, the same way the state issues bonds for community colleges and higher education. One little difference is that the monies that would be available under that change to the Constitution would be matching funds to school districts that have passed their own capital construction bonds. So the funds raised by Senate Bill 273 are envisioned as an incentive for local districts to pass bonds for their schools and will especially help communities that may have a low tax base or a lot of federal and state lands in their school districts make some major investments in school buildings. So you might also remember that in 2009, and then it was extended in 2011, the legislature put together a task force on school facilities, which Carol was a part of, and unfortunately the funding for that task force fell through. But the task force did reinforce the major need for capital improvements in K-12 buildings across Oregon. And I think if you drive in any of your school districts, you'll see old buildings, temporary buildings that were never envisioned as being long-term classrooms. So the need is overwhelming. We know there's literally billions of dollars of capital construction needs and deferred maintenance costs in districts. So Senate Bill 273, knowing that the state has limited resources to help local districts, we wrote the bill to prioritize a few specific areas, areas that school facilities experts tell us are the greatest need, and areas where we know there are new state mandates for K-12 coming up in the next few years. So I'll briefly run through, they're in the bill, but the first priority area would be building or retrofitting instructional space for full-day kindergarten. We know in 2015 that formula change is going to happen. Most districts are going to probably switch over to full-day kindergarten, and we know that there are districts that are going to need classroom space and renovation to accommodate that. The second thing is the physical education mandate, which comes on board in 2017. There's plenty of data that shows that there are going to be districts that are going to need to expand their physical education facility capacities in order to meet that mandate when it comes on board. Tsunami and earthquake upgrades and retrofits. There are, just to give you an example, I actually serve on it. There's a small amount of state money for seismic rehabilitation for K-12, about $6.5 million this biennium. This is the binder of applications our committee received. We had over 30 school projects, shovel-ready, seismic dangerous buildings that kids go to school in every day. We had enough money this biennium to pay for six of those projects. So just to give you an example of the overwhelming need for seismic and tsunami projects. Health and safety, you've probably all heard stories about asbestos, mold, and other unsafe materials in some of our school buildings. That would be a priority under Senate Bill 273. And finally, things that would improve student achievement in the context of 40-40-20. So looking at projects that would increase learning opportunities for students, extended day programs, computer labs, things like that. So those are the things that are prioritized in the bill. We also believe there are some additional benefits for our communities and when they raise funds under Senate Bill 273. The local school districts have to have some skin in the game. The local communities and the local school boards still decide what projects are funded. And if you can increase capital investments, there's going to be construction jobs in many of our struggling communities. It could also make the difference for a small town that maybe has a company thinking about locating there or expanding. Obviously, we know high-quality school facilities and programs are at the top of many companies' lists, so we think there's some ancillary benefits to this as well. And I think the bottom line for the School Boards Association and other people in the school community, we enjoy that this bill enjoys the support of COSA, OEA, OSEA, Stand for Children, and the Oregon PTA, probably one of the few bills you'll see all of us on together this session, but it's nice to have everybody on board with this. But the bottom line for us is, in our opinion, every student deserves to have a quality facility, and Bruce is going to talk a little bit about how school environments can make a big difference for student learning. So with that, I'm going to stop and let Bruce and Carol offer their comments, and I'd also be happy to answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas and members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Bruce Leathers, and I am the manager of construction services for the Sam Keiser School District. The majority of my current responsibilities is the management and execution of work funded by a 2008 $242 million construction and repair and renovation bond that the Salem voters passed. I have worked in school facility management for the past 15 years, and I am a member, and I have been a member of the Oregon Facilities Management Association that entire time. I have served on the acronym for that is OSMA's board for 9 of those 15 years, and have held several association offices, including president of the association from 2006-2007. It is from the OSMA platform and my experience managing 3 different bonds in 2 different school districts that I will highlight some of the major facility conditions that Senate Bill 273 would allow to be addressed. Briefly, the role played by our school facilities in our educational quest for a continual improvement in student achievement is to provide comfortable, safe, secure, healthy, functional, and non-distracting learning environments. Statewide, optimum facility conditions are compromised or negatively impacted by various design and maintenance shortfalls. Some of the more common conditions or shortfalls in our school facilities that create these negative effects and limits the facility's contribution to student achievement include, as mentioned, the mold, lead, asbestos, seismic safety issues. Thermal comfort, which covers it's a wide range. It's from heat to cold to indoor air quality to having headaches to trying to pass an assessment test in a computer lab that's 95 degrees, et cetera. Lighting, natural lighting. It's known that natural lighting is a better environment in which to learn. Overall learning atmospheres, that's the non-distracting part. The focus of the facility needs to be to get the student to focus on the teacher. Many of our environments in their condition, they're worried about whether or not water's going to hit them in the head. Efficient and effective functionality of adjacencies, and what I mean by that is that if your technology is in another building and your second graders need to get to it, it's very difficult. It takes a lot of time, and it impacts the ability of the teacher and the amount of student achievement they can attain when they're teaching. And then the last is modern technologies and learning labs. The age of many of our facilities are in excess of 40 years, and consequently, modern technology is a problem. During the past 4 years, Sam Keiser School District completed over $92 million worth of repair and renovation facility work. All projects completed were categorized by Sam Keiser as dead or dying, and each was of a value to repair of over $50,000. So we just hit big ticket items. Following all this repair and renovation work, there still remains over $60 million of urgently needed repairs in Sam Keiser. Through my close involvement with OSMA, I can state with confidence that Salem-Keizer pre-bond condition was average or even slightly above average for school conditions statewide. The enormity of these school facility needs makes Senate Bill 273 a high priority to facilities people. Our challenges over the past, I want to close with the facility condition issue is made worse by our challenges over the past 5 years with state funding, which includes school funding, and Senate Bill 273 can help alleviate this also. With the economic challenges, schools were forced to make cuts, and schools naturally and correctly so moved to protect the classroom size, okay, and the curriculums. And the support services, which includes facilities, custodial, and some of the other support services, absorbed as much as the hit that could possibly be absorbed by them. That consequently speeds up the degradation of our facilities, if you will. And so consequently, just because of the economic environment that we don't control, the situation is getting worse at a faster rate than it has had previously. So again, Senate Bill 273 is a vehicle by which many of these issues can be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, and members of the committee, my name is Carol Samuels. I'm a senior vice president at Seattle Northwest Securities Corporation. My company is the leading provider of financial consulting services to Oregon school districts that seek to issue bonds for capital projects. As such, I see significant benefits to Senate Bill 273, and I am here today to speak in support of this bill. As you've heard from the other speakers today, there's no question that our school districts have dire facility needs. The needs are pervasive and all-encompassing. From the smallest district to the largest, our school buildings are often old, unsafe, and inefficient. They are certainly not the facilities that will enable our districts to offer the level of education desired by the governor, the legislature, the Department of Education, or local school boards. While some districts have been successful, like Salem, at obtaining support for facilities funding from local voters, many have not, despite multiple attempts. Moreover, even in those cases where voters have been sympathetic to a school district's request, the needs have far outstripped their willingness to vote yes for the full amount of what's needed. The obvious reason for voter reluctance? The cost. Although the state cannot in this economic environment and should not, in my opinion, take on full responsibility for funding facilities for K-12 schools, it seems problematic to me that while there is generally equal funding for operations, the funding for facilities is wholly unequal and largely dependent on local voter support. Further, given the vastness of the need, my belief is that local communities cannot shoulder this burden alone. For that reason, we believe the state has a role to play in providing a portion of facility support. In my opinion, Senate Bill 273 strikes not just a fair balance, but provides an important strategic element in its approach. Specifically, we believe that the matching grant format will provide an incentive to voters to not just approve a local school district's request, but potentially to approve more than a one-to-one matching relationship, thus allowing districts to maximize facilities funding. I base this statement on our experience with a series of federal programs developed under the ERA stimulus package in 2009. These programs, known as Qualified School Construction Bond Program and the Qualified Zone Academy Bond Program, that was provided to many of the schools in each of your districts, provided subsidized funding for K-12 capital construction. Although dissimilar in format, they provided a federal payment for the interest expense associated with a school district borrowing rather than providing a portion of the principal. The concept of lowering taxpayer cost is the same. Two key examples will show how these incentives were effective tools in maximizing voter support. First is Ontario School District in Malheur County. Over 30 years, the district had attempted to obtain voter support for a general obligation bond 5 times without success. In May 2010, in the middle of the recession, they were successful in persuading the voters to approve an issue of $18.5 million by a margin of 58%. This was exactly the same amount that they had requested 2 years earlier in November of 2008. What was the difference? There are always many elements to what contributes to voter success, but the opportunity presented by the QSCAB program was clearly key. This program reduced the tax rate per thousand over the 2008 issue by nearly 50 cents per thousand. The interest expense was reduced by $10 million, and the term was shortened from 20 years to 17. Thus, for a savings of $10 million, voters approved 18 and a half. My second example is Philomath School District in Benton County. The district had bonds that were scheduled to be largely paid off in 2011, yet it had immediate facility needs that were pressing as early as 2009. Because of the opportunities presented by the QSCAB program, Philomath was able to both accelerate and increase their request to the voters. Specifically, they were able to obtain support for a $29 million bond issue while projecting interest savings of $15 million. Again, not a one-to-one relationship. And not only was this the largest bond issue ever approved in Philomath, but it was approved by an 80% margin. The ability to make the case that the federal government was going to supply a piece of the pie made a huge difference in obtaining voter support. Districts large and small benefited from these programs between 2009 and 12, including Bandon, Dallas, Eugene, Forest Grove, Hermiston, Imbler, Lincoln County, Myrtle Point, Park Rose, Salem-Keizer, Tigard-Tualatin, and Vernonia, large, small, urban, rural alike. Each of these districts was able to successfully describe the QSCAB, QSAB program benefits in their efforts to achieve voter support. My belief is that the program envisioned by Senate Bill 273 can provide similar benefits. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Samuels, you're from Washington?
I'm from Portland, actually.
Okay. I'm just curious, does Washington use state bonds for school construction?
They do, Mr. Chairman. They have a program that is similar to how Senate Bill 273 envisions the Oregon program will take place.
Can you walk us through, anyone, how this would work on the ground? It's a one-for-one, dollar-for-dollar match.
So, Mr. Chair, what we would envision, Brian Reeder from the Department of Education managed the QSAB and QSCAB programs that Carol described. And the way the bill's written, it would give the state Board of Education the authority to develop rules based on the five priorities in the bill on how you would develop criteria for that. And we've actually had some initial meetings with Mr. Reeder and some other folks at the Department of Education on how we would do that. Obviously, whatever the size, if any, is included in the co-chair's budget that the legislature ultimately passes, will determine how that goes. But some of the things that we'd like to see, you know, certain amounts available for both large and small districts, because one of the questions we get all the time is, if you put $100 million in here, wouldn't a big district like Salem-Keizer or Beaverton or Portland just eat all that up? So there would be some criteria in there, and districts would have to apply and make the case for why their projects meet the need. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add that we've talked about.
No, I think that covers
okay.
it.
But the idea would be that the matching money would be available to provide incentives to districts. As Carol described, we've seen multiple examples where small pots of money that aren't even a one-to-one match for districts have made a huge difference in communities that have been unable to pass bonds. There's different ways to do it. We could, the way the legislation works, it could be either a grant program. So, for example, if a school district passed a $50 million bond, they could come to the Department of Education and ask for, say, $10 million to furnish and provide computer labs for the new school buildings they're going to make. That would be one possibility. Another possibility would essentially be the bond proceeds from Senate Bill 273 would underwrite the interest payment. So essentially, the districts could borrow the money at no interest, and those bond proceeds would help decrease the interest payments and offset them for the school districts. So again, the communities have to have a little bit of skin in the game, and we'd envision a process much like we do for seismic, where people would bring their proposals forward, and we'd have a group of people that would evaluate them and prioritize them based on what passes and whatnot. And then the other question is, if a project is approved and then the voters ultimately don't approve that, we'd just go down the list to the next project if something were approved. So,
Why by rule and not by law on the matches and the...
That's a good question, Mr. Chair. We've discussed that. I think, in our opinion, by prioritizing those five areas, those are areas that both educational and facilities experts have identified through various reporting mechanisms and task force that we've had are priority areas, and it would give some latitude to those projects. We think they're also drafted broadly enough. Well, another way to answer your question is we don't want, you know, football fields built with this money. We need to prioritize it for student learning, health and safety, and things like that. I think that's the opinion of a lot of the folks that work on this. So we want to limit it to things that impact student achievements or are going to help school districts prepare for requirements that the legislature has placed on them that will require updating facilities or adding additional facilities. So we think that's where the money should be prioritized for.
What do you have against football?
Mr. Chairs, you know nothing.
I heard that one of your criteria was football fields. It was exercise and physical education that's coming forth, and a field that is not mud would be very successful for students that had to work outside. So, I it's one of your priorities. I could make my case.
Further questions? Senator Cruz?
Just a clarification, Morgan, because you made the assumption in your presentation relative to kindergarten that we would be at full day K in 15. I believe that there is the decision point in 15, so based on our ability to pay for it. So just a clarification
on that. Senator Cruz, as you know, the formula does change, and we'll obviously come back and press the legislature to provide the financial resources to help pay for that formula change. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 273?
I have a problem with this one.
Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on 273. How are we doing?
That's pretty exciting.
All right. Well, we will start a public hearing on Senate Bill 11. This is a bill sponsored by the Oregon State Treasurer, and he is en route or on his way. We'll just stand in recess momentarily until he comes in.
Why don't we just move this? Are you ready for it? You have problems here? Okay. I mean, the concept.
We're in a public hearing on SJR 1, Tad Wheeler.
And SB
11. SB 11. I'm open up, I'll make sure I open up a public hearing on SB 11 and SJR 1 simultaneously. Tad Wheeler. And his panel.
And the star of our show. Chair House, member of the committee. Members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting us here today to talk a little bit about the Oregon Opportunity Initiative, otherwise known as SB 11. And Chair Haas, in particular, I want to thank you for your championing this important cause and your leadership and extending the invitation to us to be here today. We're obviously going to briefly outline this, talk about some of the recent developments, and open it up for any questions, comments that you may have at your discretion. By way of context, the State Treasury is very much involved in higher education access and affordability issues. By statute, we are the administrators of the Oregon College Savings Plan. So we spend a lot of time talking with students, their families. We listen to their aspirations and their concerns and needs, and much of that is worked into the structure of the so-called Oregon Opportunity Initiative.
And for the record, you are State Treasurer.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator. I'm State Treasurer Ted Wheeler, for the record, and with me is Michael Savaggio from the State Treasury. I apologize, Chair.
No.
All of us in this room have spent a considerable amount of time thinking of ways to help move our economy. The discussion usually focuses on how can we move jobs to Oregonians. This flips the frame a little bit. This is more about how do we get Oregonians to the jobs. But the Oregonians we're talking about are Oregonians with the right training, the right tools, the right education, so that they can compete for the jobs that currently exist today and that we expect to exist in a global economy going forward. What does the initiative do? In a nutshell, it increases student aid to make higher education and vocational training more accessible and affordable to Oregonians. It does so by creating a permanent growing fund dedicated to student aid. It would be available to all students who are currently eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, and if the requirements or criteria for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program were ever changed by the legislature or the administrators, that flexibility is, of course, worked into the bill. That means at present this serves in students who want to attend two-year community colleges, students who want to attend four-year community colleges, and there is a significant goal built into the Opportunity Initiative to encourage vocational and technical training. All of us have met with employers in advanced manufacturing, in the healthcare professions, in technology fields that have jobs that are available for Oregonians today. And they don't necessarily need employees with four-year degrees or even two-year associate's degrees, but they do require some degree of technical training. And that's why we're broadening the scope to include that particular component. I would also just make a note that these are the students who are most in need. Since they qualify for the opportunity grant today, that means that they are eligible for Pell Grants. That means they tend to be at the lower end of the economic spectrum. I mention that simply because if you move this to a purely free market mechanism, you may be able to fill the seats in your community colleges, in your four-year universities, but these are the students who will be outbid, and they will likely be outbid by students from elsewhere. That may be fine for some people, but those of us who helped create the Opportunity Initiative, our goal here is to connect Oregonians with those jobs and those future economic opportunities. The need is obvious. The cost of higher education in Oregon is high for our students, and it's getting higher at a rapid clip. In fact, the latest data shows that students in Oregon are paying about 18% more than the national average in terms of fees and tuition. That increase has been fairly rapid between the years of 2004 and 2012. The costs have increased by 50%. Cost of higher education to students has greatly outstripped income growth in the state of Oregon. On the other hand, student aid that's available for those students is anemic. While the Opportunity Grant Program is a good program, it has been severely resource constrained in recent years. The net result is that student aid available for our Oregon students is 20% less than the national average. In fact, only 2 out of every 10 students who qualify for and apply to the Opportunity Grant Program receive any funding at all. That means 8 out of 10 students who qualify, who apply, are getting exactly $0.00 in terms of student aid. Student debt, of course, is growing rapidly. We're all familiar with that $1 trillion number that's been out there for quite a while now in terms of national student debt. There's a number of sources that now say that that student debt has surpassed personal credit card debt in the United States, and Oregon is not free from that trend. Between the years 2005 and 2010, that's the last year for which we have data, student debt in the state of Oregon increased by 21%. There's obviously a huge economic development component here. You have or you will be provided a packet of data. I don't know if we gave them the slides. They've got them apparently, which show that students who participate in higher education have much better earnings prospects. So the disparity between those with and without higher education degrees is already significant, and it in fact is growing. The benefits of the initiative are obvious. Some are obvious, some are not so obvious. The obvious benefits, of course, are that student aid makes education more accessible and affordable to Oregon students. It obviously helps to reduce student debt. In part, that is why the Oregon Opportunity Initiative is endorsed by the Oregon Student Association and the Oregon Community College Student Association. It also helps grow the Oregon economy by connecting the skills and the training with the jobs that are available in our economy today and in the future. And that's why this has been endorsed by the Oregon Business Association, and that's why higher education access and affordability is a key component of the Oregon Business Plan, which has been endorsed by all of the major Oregon business associations. This is one way that we know we can start to reverse the trend in per capita wage growth. Currently, our per capita wage growth lags the rest of the nation. This is one way that we know we can start to address and turn the tide on that. Some of the not-so-obvious benefits. This increases economic self-sufficiency for Oregonians and their families. That's good for all of us because it reduces costs in other expensive areas of government. It reduces reliance on social services, and we have the data to support that. It reduces interactions with the healthcare system. We have the data to support that. It reduces interactions with the public safety system. We have data to support that. And other areas where we in government are trying to contain the growth of costs. This is also part of the answer to how we achieve the legislature and the governor's collective goals of 40-40-20. Those goals are ambitious goals. This is part of the answer of how we get to 40-40-20 and how we pay for 40-40-20. In terms of how the Opportunity Initiative works, it's very straightforward. We're proposing to issue two tranches of general obligation debt at $250 million apiece. The proceeds from that debt would go into a pool that would be managed on an investment basis, very similar, if not identical, to the Common School Fund. The proceeds would then go towards servicing the debt and towards supporting higher education student aid. 1 year after the bonds are issued, give or take, this would generate about $25 million in additional revenues for student aid. That would represent a 50% increase in the amount of funding that's available for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. This bill does suggest some strategies for the future. There are a number of different parties, the legislature, Rudy Crewe, the governor, this committee. There's a lot of different parties looking at how to best spend those resources. The bill is agnostic. We've created a structure and a source of funding. We've left it up to the experts to determine how best to spend it. But there's three areas where we've suggested that the administrators of the Opportunity Grant Program come back to this committee or to a designated committee of the legislature and report back on three areas. The first is incentives for critical degrees or STEM degrees, science, technology, engineering, and math. And this is a significant request of the business community. The second is to look at incentives for vocational and technical training. The third area is to look at incentives to help students or encourage students to graduate on time. You may have just heard about the withering needs around capacity and infrastructure. One way to help reduce those costs is to get more students through the same facilities faster. That has the impact of both reducing costs, increasing capacity, and reducing, ultimately, student debt. Finally, I will close by saying we do not see this as a panacea for all of the issues confronting our economy or all of the issues, indeed, confronting the higher education spectrum of needs. You're going to see bills around governance, around capacity, around infrastructure, around cost containment, around access and affordability like this one. We believe this is a part of a larger puzzle, if you will, towards how we could make our higher education system the best in the nation. We do, however, see it as being a critical component, access and affordability. And therefore, we would encourage your support as this process unfolds. We'd be happy to take any comments or questions or thoughts you may have at your discretion. Thank you, Chair Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. We very much appreciate you coming up here. I know you had a busy schedule today, and supportive, very, very supportive of the goals you have in this effort. And let me ask you to address a couple of things that I know you've been asked about already. First, could you speak as a treasurer about the capacity and about the philosophical notion of using bond proceeds for something other than capital construction, which is kind of the traditional way that those proceeds are used?
Yeah, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. This is a new way of looking at the use of our bonding capacity. Typically, bonds are used for hard infrastructure, buildings, bridges, facilities like that that have a long-term economic impact. That's not to say that we as a state have always used it with such diligence. This is an asset that we are investing in that delivers economic benefits over the long term. So I think it qualifies under the criteria of bond usage. What we're building is a permanent, growing, and dedicated fund towards higher education access and affordability, which we know can help drive our economy forward and provide an outstanding workforce and economic self-sufficiency for our citizens. That is the competitive asset that we're investing in. It is permanent, and we see that as a competitive advantage to other states. And of course, as you pointed out, Chair Haas, in the original opening, there is also a Senate Joint Resolution number 1 that will have to be passed with this, which is a referral to the voters. Because it is a new use for our state's debt capacity, ultimately the decision rests with the taxpayers and the voters.
Mm-hmm. I noticed the election date wasn't filled in. It's not the next general election. Would it be your intent to go sooner, later, special election?
Senator Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the State Treasurer's Office. And we did make the decision to put a blank line on the election date because we simply focused a lot of effort on trying to hammer out the financial mechanisms and, to be frank, just have not looked at whether it would make sense to call a special election this November statewide, or wait until the May primary, which is already set up as an election. And I think that we just wanted to, before committing to a date, talk with some people about the benefits and disadvantages to each of those.
Senator Roman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at the combination of the two, we have a fund, a new fund that's being developed that can accept this money, for one, which will never be spent, and eventually it will continue to grow, I would assume, and that other money can be put in. Donations can be accepted and put into it as well. So do we have a thought about marketing that issue to get more money into this fund and therefore retire the debt sooner or just use the new principal to make larger?
Chair House, members of the committee, the question was the measure anticipates money coming from other sources, such as gifts, bequests, that sort of thing, and what can that be used for? And at the end of the day, we wanted to keep that option very broad, so we have not proscribed in either the legislation or the joint resolution. However, I can discuss some of the allowances that we've made, which is we could choose to put that money into debt service to retire some bonds early. Alternatively, we could choose to seek out higher returns and actually generate additional revenue off of that. And I think that the reason we wanted to keep that flexible was because this is a very long-term roadmap that we're setting up, and we might be in a situation where we have we're looking at ridiculously high returns, and we do want to roll that into investments because maybe we're already locked into a low interest rate. Alternatively, we might be looking at a terrible investment market 20 years from now, and we want to retire some of the debt that we have. So the short answer is we're allowing for the future legislatures, future administrators to make a select from a menu of possible decisions based on the circumstances at the time.
Okay. Chair Haas, members of the committee, I neglected to answer the second half of Chair Haas's question, and I would, now that I've remembered it, I'd like to get back to that. He'd asked me about the capacity issue. We have approximately $900 million available for this biennium in the general obligation category of debt. So the ask here is for half of that, $500 million, so a little more than half of that. And we ask that completely aware of the fact that there are other competing priorities, and ultimately you have to decide where those priorities lie. This was accounted for in the governor's executive budget under the strategic initiatives portion of his general obligation debt outlay. This does not impact the transportation bonds that will be supported for the CRC, presumably by other revenues. This doesn't impact other economic development priorities that are funded with lottery debt. This is a big ask, and we know it, and it reflects both the need and what we see as the opportunity going forward.
Thank you for that. I'm sorry, Senator Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Treasurer, essentially this is an arbitrage strategy. So you're going to borrow $500 million at today's low interest rates, form the corpus. How long before it starts throwing off a revenue stream under your assumptions, and what's that stream?
Why don't you go ahead and Senator Beyer through Chair House, if I could just do the introduction, and Michael's gone wild with his modeling. I'm somewhat reluctant to refer to this as an arbitrage strategy, although there is no question that with the conservative economic assumptions we've built into this model, we are assuming a relatively high cost of capital at 5.5% is what we are assuming we will issue these bonds at. Currently, we're getting 2.7 to 3.0. We are assuming a lower rate of return than what we assume for the pension plan or other state investments. Those are currently pegged at 8%, and you know my views on that. This assumes 7%. So in the near term, we feel very comfortable, but over the long term, to be fully disclosed, it is an investment, and all investments carry risk.
Mm-hmm. The Chair asked members of the committee to get to the question that Senator Beyer asked. The under those assumptions, I'm just going to make one small clarification. The assumed interest rate of 5.5% is what we assume over as an average over the 30-year roadmap that we've kind of drafted out. clearly, interest rates are lower than that average this year. So, to make a guess, as much as I hate to do that, to make a guess, even though I hate to guess on rates, if we issued $500 million at some point over the next year, we have to keep two things in mind. Firstly, that were, as our debt manager reminded us, these are going to be taxable bonds simply because federal arbitrage rules. We will have to be, or we will not be able to derive a federal tax-exempt benefit off of these. Assuming that we were able to get, say, 4.5% over the next, by selling these over the next year or two, to answer Senator Barr's question, they start kicking out a little bit over $25 million in revenue the year after we make the final deposit. As the Treasurer mentioned, we're not planning on flooding the market with $500 million worth of bonds all in the same sale. The amount continues to raise incrementally as we pay about a total of $30.7 million in debt service every year. The there's a difference, obviously, between that debt service and the revenue initially. However, after 12 years, the amount of revenue grows to the point where it exceeds the debt service. And at that point, the legislature can choose to extinguish those bonds or simply continue paying the debt service and gaining more revenue out of the permanent fund than it's paying into debt service. And that in that way, that's where this plan actually starts to pencil out. The plan was, we actually put together a longer-term roadmap that I think you have in the handout in front of you, and that should be the little chart with the big green line shooting up to the upper right. And that green line represents the total size of the permanent fund that grows to a projected $6 billion over 30 years. Again, that's not a commitment to any future legislatures. That's just an example of one roadmap that that the state may choose to pursue. And you'll notice that we have the teensy-eensy red and blue dotted lines on the bottom, which represent the debt service and revenue, respectively. So that they pretty much track each other up until a 30-year point where the bonds start being paid off, and then the revenue continues to increase as the debt service slowly dwindles down to nothing. So that's the real meat and potatoes of the plan, is that ideally we're making these debt service payments, but we're retaining ownership of the permanent fund in that I think the Treasurer's fund is saying that we're actually beginning to become buyers in the opportunity grant as opposed to renters. We're paying for permanence, in essence. And that's the benefit here.
Senator Beyer kind of polluted my mind here with this arbitrage word, and so if you can just kind of play this out, say voters pass it next year, then you issue $250 million, and then 6 months later another $250. What does that look like then? Do payments typically get made on that? Where does that money come from? And what does the income stream look like? And when does it start helping students?
The short term. Senator Haas, members of the committee, I've just been instructed to give you a very short answer on that. They're general obligation bonds, so the payments would come out of the general fund through the normal appropriations process, as any general obligation dollars do. Similar to how the common school fund is run, the money would be handed over presumably to the Oregon Investment Council for investment, and draws would be made on that periodically, essentially deposited into the opportunity grant program. This model has been working very, very well with the Common School Fund, as the Department of State Lands has been able to reliably pass about $50 million a year to local K-12 districts, even in the face of a market that's ill-tempered? A choppy market, someone said. By structuring it in kind of an endowment model, it smooths out those returns, and we're able to get a pretty stable source of revenue coming off of that.
Thank you. So your scale here is, your lowest scale is $1 billion. What general fund contributions, the state contribution, what range are we talking about, say, in 2014, 2015, 2016?
That would be assuming the, we're talking about only the $500 million, the initial $500 million figure. We're talking about $30.7 million over the life of the bonds per year. And that's assuming a 4.5% interest rate. I don't want to make any promises as to what interest rates are going to look like when we sell the bonds. But if I'm very far off, I think Laura Lockham McCall will throw a shoe at me.
I'm lost.
but then you're also investing this money, like in endowment, like the common school fund.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And so will that end up being something of a wash, or did we get off track here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, assuming, according to the projections that we've made, and I actually have a little spreadsheet that I can get to every member of the committee after the hearing's over, but according to our projections, the state will be paying more in debt service than it's getting in revenue for about the first 12 years, at which point the revenue will then, which continues to grow, will then overtake the debt service, which remains stable. It's important to note, though, that even in those 12 years, the state's coming out ahead because we maintain ownership of that fund. So so at any point in time, the state's total benefit, meaning aggregate revenue plus the amount of the fund that we own, is going to be about, to use a very, very shorthand measure, about twice what we're putting into it in terms of debt service.
And does that factor in, until you get to that point, spending, helping kids, putting money into the Opportunity Grant, doing all these things? Or do you not, start, when do you start distributing money?
Chair House, members of the committee, we would presumably start distributing that money as soon as we got the first year revenue off of the fund.
Senator Byer?
So, see if I understand this. You're going to, if authorized, whatever, some either first year over a couple of years, you're going to sell $500 million in debt. And for the first 12 years beyond that borrowing, you're going to require an annual appropriation to service the debt.
And Chair House, members of the committee, this would come out of the state's normal bonding capacity, so it would work just like any other general obligation bond, and that debt service would be added into the appropriations end-of-session bonding bill as normal. It would be paid for as part of the state's ordinary bonding capacity, just like any other bonds, just like 11Q bonds, 11P bonds are paid for today.
So your perception is that you will not... I'm assuming you're going to take the $500 million and invest it with the hope that you're going to get more interest back than you're paying. So, but your model doesn't assume that that will generate enough interest from the get-go to pay the debt service without touching the corpus?
And Chair House, members of the committee, if we were willing to touch the corpus, we could obviously pay the bonds off at any point.
I'm saying without touching the corpus. You don't think it'll throw off a nut that you won't get greater earnings than your debt services?
Chair House, members of the committee, the answer is no, because the we would be...
Sure.
If the debt service includes not just interest, but also payment of the principal. So without... being willing to cut into the corpus, which represents the principal, we would basically be comparing apples and oranges. The earnings that are coming off of that we hope outpace the interest that we're paying, will certainly, well, there's no certainty in finance, but our projections anticipate the earnings outpacing what we're paying in interest. But the debt service includes not just the interest, but also the principal. Okay. So to make the fund pay its own debt service in the first year, we would have to cut into that that corpus.
If you understand it, I'll step back. But otherwise,
Senator Roland?
No, I'm fine. Okay.
Do you have a better explanation?
I created the model, so I thought perhaps I could try. For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of Debt Management, and Mike is a wonderful gentleman, but I'm the finance geek in the group, so along with Ted. So I created the model, and I used some simple statistics, sort of historical. Most endowment funds draw between 4 to 5% a year. You know, if you draw at 4%, the endowment lasts forever. At 5%, it's a little aggressive. But just for simplicity, I assume whatever the corpus was, we would drive 5% off of it to make grants. But frankly, if you're drawing 5% off to make grants, which is the whole point of it, there's just not enough money unless you assume a much higher rate of return on the fund to do the debt service and to be able to take that 5% for grants. So we're just saying that there's debt capacity in the general fund, and so we assume that the general fund would pay the debt service on these bonds because the goal is to try and build a long-term fund. Because you could just take cash and give cash to students, and that's fine, but you wouldn't have a long-term permanent asset for the state that will grow over time, that could possibly grow at a higher rate than 7.5% in good years. But you can't do both simultaneously.
Laura, at what point would you be making grants? I guess it would be grants to students.
Through the chair, as Mike mentioned, the idea would be once the corpus is invested and you start pushing off interest, we could do that within the first few years at the 5% draw rate. So right away, within a year or two, but somebody has to pay the debt service on the GO bonds if you chose to do that.
How much you make in grants is a trade-off of how much you're going to have to get.
Yes.
A commitment from the general fund, traditional commitment, the student loan program.
And as State Treasurer mentioned, lots of circumstances change over the years. In a really good year, maybe the general fund can afford to do that. In a really, really bad year, perhaps the general fund can't afford to do that. And I think the legislation was designed to give people over a very long time choices and trade-offs in terms of how the money gets spent over time.
If I may, in your modeling, did you look at the, as opposed to just borrowing $500 million, what the difference financially looks like if the state just made a long-term commitment of putting $10 or $20 million a year into building the corpus over 30 years?
No. Not yet.
I work a lot with foundations in my other life, and we do that for 5% grants. And the hitch here is we don't have debt service. We just have the big pots, and that's how most foundations are. So that's sort of the obstacle here. And I think what I see here as a benefit is, was it 12 years down the road, then you do have this big pot, and you now are a big foundation, and debt services is no longer a burden.
No, that's good. Thanks. Thanks. Help clarify.
Thank you, Chair.
If I may, Chair House, members of the committee, to that question about what if the state just put $10 to $20 million a year into this fund. So Senate Joint Resolution 1 not only authorizes the additional bonding use, but also sets up this this constitutionally protected fund with this revenue output to student grant student aid. So once that fund is set up, the legislature could conceivably then just put $10 to $20 million a year into it, and that model would continue to work. I can't speak to the amounts that it would kick out, but that particular method would be provided for in the joint resolution that we've drafted.
I don't know how, if you listen into our previous bill here, and I don't want you to comment on it, but I'm assuming that you support, these are not mutually exclusive, that we have the capacity. I think that one was $200 million. Both of these are for education, one for capital construction, one for this. We can do both.
Chair House, members of the committee, yes.
We're obviously obviously relying on a different set of apples here from these oranges with the potential for a bridge bond too, with no revenue mechanism there. We can do that too?
Chair Hassan, members of the committee, yes. Contingent. The assumption I'm making is that if the legislature chooses to issue general obligation bonds to support the Columbia River crossing, I am assuming that those bonds would be supported with revenues, vehicle registration fee, a gas tax, something like that. If that's the case, then it does not compete for that capacity, the $900-plus million in capacity that I mentioned previously.
Okay. Further questions?
Yeah.
Senator Cruz?
A figure of 7.5% return, how real is that?
Sorry, go ahead, Michael.
Chair, House members, members of the committee, I just wanted to clarify that it's actually our projections are assuming seven.
Seven. What's the return currently on something similar?
So, Chair Hass, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, understanding that any 1 year is not a good benchmark for long-term investment results. Last year, the pension, which is a $60 billion fully diversified global investment portfolio, returned 14.3%. Over 10 years, it's a little over 8%. Over a 20-year period, it's actually a little over 9%. But your caution with regard to what is the return potential, I think, is completely valid. That's why we didn't assume 8%. We assumed the 7% in sort of in terms of returns rather than the 8% that's still assumed for the pension.
Mr. Treasurer, Mr. Savaggio, I really admire your initiative on this. No one is more aware of the need for help with higher education in this state. We really need to get our kids into and out of college, and money is the chief obstacle. So thank you for these efforts, and we look forward to working on helping you pass this.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Thanks for having us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We have some other people signed up, so let's go down the list in no particular order. Miriam Weatherhead.
My name is Miriam Weatherhead, M-E-R-R-I-A-M. Hello, Senator Haas and members of the committee. My name is Miriam Weatherhead, and I'm the board chair for the Oregon Student Association and student body president at Lane Community College. OSA represents over 100,000 students in post-secondary education in public community colleges and universities. Today, I'm here to talk to you to speak in support of Treasurer Wheeler's Oregon Opportunity Initiative. Student body presidents from all over the state unanimously support this initiative because this plan builds a sustainable model for Oregon's neediest families. Right now, only 2 out of 10 maximum need students receive the grant. This leaves thousands of students who qualify for need-based aid with limited options, students who want to go to college but can't afford to pay for it. I have been a part of that 80% who qualified but did not receive the award. I come from a low-income family, and throughout high school, college always seemed unattainable because my family couldn't afford it. So when I finally was able to sit down and apply for the FAFSA and for the Lane Community College, the deadline for the Oregon Opportunity Grant had already passed. Community colleges have rolling admissions, and due to budget cuts, the OOG operates at a university schedule, which doesn't. My first term, I was among 8 out of 10 students who qualified and applied for the Oregon Opportunity Grant but didn't receive it. This financial barrier did have a huge impact on my education. Spring term of my first year, I barely paid for rent and couldn't afford to buy books, so I didn't purchase a single book that term. That meant I spent all the time I could studying in the library with outdated textbooks that I can only check out for 2 hours at a time. These challenges unfortunately did affect whether I could get A's or whether I was able to get B's. I am lucky to know now, and and have received the Oregon Opportunity Grant for the last 2 years. This grant means that I can help pay for rent and food for my family and purchase books. Unfortunately, though, I will still have a considerable amount of debt when I graduate. This grant is crucial to low-income students, and I'm very excited about the proposal for the Oregon Opportunity Initiative. This helps make education in Oregon a real possibility for low-income students and ultimately will help Oregon reach 40-40-20. We are asking for your support, and we wanted to thank you as well for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. What school are you attending?
I attend Lane Community College.
Lane Community. You've been borrowing.
Unfortunately, community colleges, of course, were made under the assumption that you wouldn't have to take out debt, but I've had to take out debt even to attend LCC and have applied for admissions at the University of Oregon and will have to take out debt when I transfer there as well.
Well, we appreciate you coming and talking to us. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Eric Knoll.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll, and I serve as the Legislative Affairs Director in the student government at Lynn Benton Community College. And I come here in a capacity as the former chair and current board member of the Oregon Community College Student Association to speak and offer a preemptive rebuttal to the testimony submitted by Mr. Buckstein, who you will later hear from this afternoon. As well as codify our support for the Opportunity Initiative as the Oregon Community College Student Association. I would like to quote sections of his testimony and offer my rebuttal as part of mine. I quote, higher education prices are rising rapidly because of the predominant role of third-party payments, including federal and state support for institutions and students. I don't believe this is the only cost driver for education. And many other cost drivers exist, primarily a disinvestment of state funds in higher education. And to think that need-based aid like the Oregon Opportunity Grant that helps students gain access to education is being considered here as a cost driver for an education when it actually helps students pay for access to theirs. I quote, when someone else is paying a lot of the bills, students are less sensitive to the price, thus allowing the colleges to care less about keeping prices under control. I would argue that the Oregon Opportunity Grant goes to students with the most need and by far does not cover the cost of their education. Most students at a four-year public university leave with a debt of over $25,000, and if a student were to receive the maximum award for the Oregon Opportunity Grant over that four-year time span, they would relinquish less than $8,000. And while that does not come anywhere near to paying for their entire debt load, it does cover a significant amount of their debt. Regardless, they still will have to exit college with debt and have to be very, very careful about their financial situation on top of rent and paying for the cost of living. I quote, more government funding of higher education actually translates to a slower state economic growth. I would argue that students with an education graduate and enter more qualified jobs in the workforce and earn more to contribute back to the economy and become valuable members of our society. By contributing more tax dollars, that increases the economic growth of our state. I quote, so leaving the money in private hands produces better economic results. Privatization of higher education will result in skyrocketing prices for students, making education even less accessible for low-income students. If we cut public institutions like community college and universities from state funding and don't allow for students to receive grants like the Oregon Opportunity Grant, these institutions will have no choice but to make up for that lack of funding by either cutting services or by increasing our tuition, therefore making education even less accessible to students. I quote, four-year degrees
Eric,
aren't what well, the...
Eric, let me yes. Why don't you just go forward with your testimony,
okay.
And we'll let Steve come up and do his.
Okay.
It'll just be easier for, I think, everybody, maybe even you, for us to follow what you're saying. Okay, let's hear your story.
Thank you. So I personally do not receive the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but in my work with the Oregon Community College Student Association, I've worked from students from each of your districts who receive the Oregon Opportunity Grant and who tell similar stories to what Miriam told. Again, 2 out of 10 students qualifying for the grant received the grant at a full maximum award. I can tell you, Senator Canope, Senator Cruz, and Senator Roblin, that you all have been visited by students from your districts over the past year. Senator Canope, you met with Kurt Killinger during a politics forum prior to the election, and he receives the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Senator Cruz, you met with Freddie Gompf, the Vice President of Umpqua Community College Student Government, during the December legislative work days. And Senator Roblin, you met with Celise Little, Vice President of the Southwestern Oregon Community College, during their voter registration drive on campus. She is qualified for the Oregon Opportunity Grant but doesn't receive the grant. The argument that I will make in rebuttal overall to testimony against the Opportunity Initiative is that these students who qualify for the grant and or receive the grant are working very hard to receive their education. All of those students that you have met with will probably leave college with that. But in their work with the student government, it sets them up to become very valuable members of our society and contribute to the economic growth of our state. Oregon students prioritize the Opportunity Initiative because we see the Treasurer's Plan as a creative solution to a zero-sum funding problem and support a plan that will increase access to education and lower the amount of student debt after college. We believe that education is a right, not a privilege, and that taxpayers and the legislature need to take responsibility for proving this right to students and not backing away from it. And finally, we believe in a quality education that is both affordable and accessible to all Oregonians. Senator Haas and the committee, thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Eric. Any questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate your passion. All right, Steve Buckstein. Rebuttal the rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas and members of the committee. I'm Steve Buckstein, Senior Policy Analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute. We're a public policy research center based in Portland. I'm here to oppose both SB 11 and SJ 1. There was a different number in the House that Eric and I actually were on the same panel on testifying about last week. So I'll go through my testimony briefly. I think you've got it online and there's a lot of links to the research that I talk about that I hope, if you're interested, you'll be able to take a look at. And I'll make just a few rebuttals to the rebuttals where I think they might be appropriate. First off, Professor Richard Vedder from Ohio University wrote a book called Going Broke by Degree, Why College Costs Too Much. And he says that higher education prices, as Eric quoted me, are rising rapidly because of the predominant role third-party payments now play, including federal and state support for institutions and students. When someone else pays the bills, the people who are getting those bills paid are not as sensitive to price, and the institutions are less interested on the margin at controlling their costs. Nothing about this, well, the reason, again, keeping college costs down is, to students, is one reason for this opportunity initiative that the Treasurer Wheeler has brought forward. But I think the problem is that even if his investment assumptions pan out, and you talked about them quite a bit, even if they pan out, taxpayers in Oregon will be on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars of capital and interest payments for decades, because their approach, while they can't bind future legislatures, their approach is to pay the payments on the bonds over those 30 years from the general fund. And I think you may hear more about that later from another opponent of these bills, from coming from a slightly different perspective. So you're saddling basically taxpayers with debt over 30 years. And worse yet, there is evidence, even though Eric, I'm sure we'll challenge it, and some of you may challenge it, and there's, as Mike Savaggio says, there's nothing certain in these things, but there is quite a bit of evidence, hundreds of regression analyses, I've got some of them with me, that I've shared with him, actually, that do point out that in the aggregate, more government funding for higher education actually translates to slower state economic growth. It doesn't mean it reduces economic growth. It means that when you compare, when you hold, it's a complicated formula, but when you look at all the variables involved that you can identify in economic growth and state funding of higher education, and you hold different things constant, what comes out in almost every case in these regression analyses is that the more state and local funding of higher education, the slower the economic growth is in the future, 5, 10, 15 years in the future, when these students have gotten their education, they are productive in the economy, they are still not as productive as you would want in relation to doing things different ways. That's my speculation, is that's because individuals know their own, basically their own needs better than politicians do, with all due respect, and that they produce, when they invest their own money, they produce better economic results for the state. Nothing in that, I think he might have misunderstood. I was not arguing that we should privatize higher education. I was saying that leaving those bond payments in the hands of Oregon taxpayers over that 30 years will likely lead to better economic results in the state than putting them into a plan like this. Further, there are other academics, such as Charles Murray and Carl Bankstrom, and I have links to some of their papers in my testimony, joined Dr. Vetter in arguing that four-year degrees aren't what they used to be. I have a four-year degree. I assume some of you do. I have a bachelor's degree on top of that. But over the last few decades, the percentage of Oregonians and Americans who have acquired four-year degrees has risen rapidly to the point where they may be a gateway to entry to employment, but they tell the employer virtually nothing about your skill or ability to be productive in their business. And I think putting more money into a plan like this without looking at it very carefully may be wasting precious taxpayer, both financial and human resources. But all that said, if the goal of the 40-40-20 goal, getting more Oregonians to get four-year degrees and get two-year degrees, is a worthy one, if that's the case, I think you need to step back and look at efforts in other states to make it, to really bend the cost, not just bend the cost curve down, but break the cost curve and greatly reduce the cost of higher education, because, again, I would argue third-party payments have really been a major cost driver in higher ed. Of course, as Eric says, there are other cost drivers, but that's been, I think, a huge one. Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute wrote at the end of January in the New York Times that one idea gaining traction, which I believe was actually first mentioned by Bill Gates of Microsoft, who doesn't have a college degree, by the way, but is the idea of the $10,000 college degree, which public universities in several states are moving towards right now. I think all 23 public institutions in Florida have said that they're committed to try to find a way to create $10,000 four-year degrees that actually have value. And that's not $10,000 a year. That's $10,000 for a four-year degree. According to Brooks, and this really got my attention, this is exactly the kind of innovation we would expect in an industry that's showing every indication of a bubble about to burst. You've heard, I don't think it was here, but you've heard that we have maybe $1 trillion in student debt in this country now, maybe more than credit card debt. We look at the housing bubble, we look at the dot-com bubble. Brooks is worried, and I think others are, that the student aid and higher education could be another bubble that may be about to burst. So in conclusion, I'm not questioning at all the value of a college degree to an individual. It's been very valuable to me. I'm sure yours have been valuable to you. What I'm questioning is that state funding of those degrees in the current situation with the current costs involved is likely to cost taxpayers more than they gain. So with that, I'll conclude and open up for any questions or rebuttal or rebuttal.
Thank you, Steve. You know, one of the things that is driving up the cost of public universities and tuition is that states like Oregon have been contributing less and less and less and less, so particularly over the past decade, driving up the cost of tuition at community colleges and sort of doing exactly what you think we should do, but then that makes it even more difficult for these two students, for example, to get the opportunities that you and I had a generation ago. How do you help provide bright kids like these with that opportunity? And whether it's a four-year degree or a six-year degree or a PhD, there's no doubt that high school graduates today need a lot of training, need technical skills, need a college education, or some kind of post-secondary help to function in today's economy.
Chair Haas, that's a very good question. In addition to the driving the cost down, finding ways to drive the cost down of a four-year degree to, say, $10,000, I think part of the problem, as Charles Murray points out, is that there's, other than some very technical fields, medicine, law, some others, there are very few fields that require 4 years in a classroom before you're competent to do the work. Very few. And I understand that the Opportunity Initiative envisions including technical and vocational fields. A lot of those pay more than four-year college degrees today once you get the knowledge and the competence. I would encourage, in fact, I agree with very few things that Tim Nesbitt says in the past, but he had an article in the Oregonian recently where, in effect, what he said was that more and more employers are realizing that competence is more important than credentials. And I think that's been true for quite a while, and we haven't recognized it. If our goal is to get 40% of students to a four-year bachelor's degree, I think that's almost a vacuous goal. I mean, yeah, you can measure it, but what have you got when you get done? A lot of those degrees, other than, you know, hard sciences, may not be very valuable in the economy going forward. So we have to look at just helping students get a four-year degree may not be helping them. In fact, Microsoft, when it was starting out, James Fallows of The Atlantic wrote a book called More Like Us a few years ago, comparing America to the Japanese. And he talked about how high school students, high school graduates going to look for jobs, these new computer nerds, you know, going to look for jobs at Microsoft. The Microsoft HR people, in many cases, were trying to talk them out of going to college on the grounds that neither Microsoft nor the student could afford to waste 4 years. College degree is not, again, what it used to be, as a lot of these professors say. And when you look at the research that Dr. Vetter and others are doing, it's probably very overpriced. And the fact that Oregon has been reducing its funding, state funding to the universities and driving up the cost of tuition, you have to look at the total. The total has gotten way out of hand. And yes, you don't want to see the whole burden on the students, but that may be a signal that maybe it's not as valuable as it used to be, and maybe there are other ways they can become competent at a lot lower price.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a statement and a question for you. I think one of the things that the legislature can do to lower costs for these students is to reform PERS this session. But beyond that, Steve, you mentioned in your testimony we should look at other states and what they've done to significantly reduce costs. Do you have any states that we should point to, look at?
Chair Haas, Senator Knope, they're just getting started as far as I know. Both Texas and Florida are looking at this. I believe there's some others, but I did see a statement actually just a few days ago that the governor of Florida put out the charge to all the public universities in the state, come up with a way to provide these degrees for $10,000, and all 23 basically have said, yes, we're going to look to do it. And it may very well be a combination, again, as Tim Nesbitt pointed out in his Oregonian column the other day, a combination of classroom and online learning. There are a lot of creative ways that can cut down the cost, and at least those two states I know are seriously looking at doing it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jody Wise.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So we're not opposing this legislation, but we do have a couple of suggestions. As I think you were feeling, Senator Beyer, it's kind of scary to think that at a time when we're only giving opportunity grants to 20% of the kids that need it, and it's a lottery, they might get it 1 year and not get it again in their 4 or 5 years it takes to complete their education, so it's not something they can plan on. It's really hard to look at the idea that we would be reducing the money available in the general fund in order to get this idea going. It's like hurt this generation of college students to make sure we've got something for another generation of college students. And we would recommend that the legislation as written allows it to go either way. And we would recommend that you take the payment of debt, principal and interest, out of the fund itself. It'll grow a little more slowly, but you won't be damaging the kids we have now. We're only spending $50 million a year on Oregon Opportunity Grants. This year they're getting $1,950. Next year, what do you think tuition will go up? Only $50? Of course not, but the grants will go up $50. They'll get $2,000 for the full year next year. So it's, you know, we're just meeting the needs so poorly. And we've heard from students about how hard that is. And I think that we should take that into consideration rather than our desire to build this fund fast and well. This is kind of about us, our egos versus their current needs, it feels like. Another thing that I think we should consider while we're looking at this, the way that the current Oregon Opportunity Grants work and the way the legislation is set up, the funds could, it's kind of unclear who can use the funds. And currently, it looks to me like it goes to private nonprofit colleges and to public colleges, junior colleges and universities. And I think that's something we might consider. I mean, our obligation is really to the students who are going to our institutions where the tuition has gone up so quickly. And maybe instead of spreading it across all students in the state, we should look at limiting the kids that are at the institution that we as taxpayers are responsible for. The third thing I want to speak to is whether this is a good concept at all. And I felt skeptical since I heard about it. It's like, would I suggest to my sons they take the equity out of their house and put it in the stock market because they'll have enough money to pay off the equity and they'll get richer somehow? I think that the estimates that are made are rather conservative. I couldn't find a 30-year record for what you would get just on the S&P 500. I found a 25-year one. I look back to 1951 when they first started keeping the records. And the lowest return over 25 years was 5.9%. The highest return over 25 years was 17.25% a year. Those were both outliers. There was nothing close on either end. Everything was about 2 percentage points different. Really shows how timing the market is difficult, doesn't it? But most of them were in the 9 to 12% range. So if you're looking backwards, if history tells us what to do, really the 7% that's built into this is quite conservative. We've gotten the S&P returned about 14% over the last 2 years. We had a flat year, and then we had a great year. So that's historic returns. But obviously, we have to look forward, not just backwards. If we look backwards, IBM introduced the PC 30 years ago. In today's dollars, it costs $3,600. The internet, as we know it, was born 30 years ago. And in Oregon and virtually every other state, corporations still paid their taxes based on how much property they had in the state, how much payroll they had in the state, and how much sales they had in the state. So it's kind of, you know, some of the metrics that have moved over 30 years. When we look forward, we know there are things we can expect. We know we're probably going to have to share the diminishing world resources with millions more people, not just as their population growth, but there's also the fact that a lot of the world is watching TV now, and they want what we have. And we also know that global climate change is changing what we have to deal with, and we don't know what the costs are going to be for that. So it's pretty hard to predict the future. So I decided to do an experiment, and I emailed my investment advisor. I did not tell him it was a political question I was asking, and it doesn't follow things closely enough to know about this. So he assumed that that's what it was. I wrote in my email, advice, would you advise me to take out a mortgage on my home? and invest the money in the market. My home is fully paid for, likely worth $700,000 since the lot can be now be subdivided into four additional lots. So I could easily borrow $500,000. Tony's answer was, when he called me on Saturday, "That's what I love about you, Jody. You're always willing to take a risk." So note, he did say take a risk, but listen to the other part of it. He said, go out there, get a mortgage on your house right away, get a 30-year mortgage, and I don't know how it's going to do in the long term, but I can get you a 12 to 13% return over the next 3 years. And that's quite a bit of money. So that's kind of, you know, that's kind of where it is. I mean, it's like hurry up, you do that. And he knows that I'm going to take a draw to live on every month, and it'll have to be bigger in order to pay my mortgage that I would then have. I was surprised, but you still have to ask yourselves, and that's really the question that's before you, is this a prudent idea? The fact that the corpus is basically going to be intact means that you really don't have a terrible amount at risk, because even if things kind of go sideways, it's not going to really disappear. You know, you might have, what do we have? A 30% drop once? That's the most we've ever really lost. So, okay. Have fun with your decision.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you for your comments. Joel, please.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, senior policy analyst with the Oregon Business Association, here to testify in support of the bill. The Oregon Business Association supports policies that help move us closer to our goal of 40-40-20. The OBA supports the Opportunity Initiative as one of those policies that can help move us closer to that goal. And we'll be looking for more information as to what other capital projects may be affected as other key choices are made here in the capital. The high cost of tuition is a major barrier to students in Oregon. Oregon has relied on an import strategy for an educated workforce, and we view the Opportunity Initiative as one piece that can help address that problem. In conclusion, we support the Opportunity Initiative. That's all. Thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Joel. Any questions for the OBA? Thank you.
Thanks.
No. Okay. And this ends our day on bonding. We will go after these again, possibly with some amendments. We do have referrals, I think, on all of these bills, so they will not go straight to the floor, but we need to work some more on them. So, committee, if there's no further business, Senator Beyer?
No.
You okay? We are adjourned.